You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
Atamarie, ko henaros toku wingua, amake na parire o tene wiki. Welcome to this week's bits. This week, we talked the low pay hospitality workers receive, how big of an issue it is that NZ still has one of the highest suicide rates in the world, and a new book called The Roaring Silence. First up, according to a Radio New Zealand report released last Wednesday, hospitality bosses say they are struggling to get locals to apply for jobs and need skilled migrants to stay in the country to keep the industry going. Hospitality workers have hit back, saying that if they want more New Zealand staff, they need to pay more. 95BFM reporter Ruben McLaren spoke to Chloe King, a hospitality veteran, who has launched a workers' campaign called Raise the Bar.
There's been like a massive bar boom in Auckland, for example, but there's been absolutely no boom in our wages, regardless of our experience, as was illustrated in that Radio New Zealand report by a hospital worker called Bella, who had 15 years' experience. In hospo, she was only offered $20 an hour, and I've got about 12 years experience in hospitality, and I'm really ever offered anything more than minimum wage or just a dollar above. So if you pay us poverty wages, then expect us to work incredibly hard for almost nothing. That is predominantly the reason why we're over it. We've had enough, you know, like that's why they're struggling to attract New Zealand workers, not because we're lazy or drug addled or whatever. Yeah.
So do you think Kiwis are in competition with migrant workers?
Absolutely not. I think that migrant workers have every right to come to this country on visas, on student visas, and etch out a better life for themselves. I think the pitting of workers against each other, particularly low-wage workers, is just another way for us to compete against each other for shitty wages and jobs that are not that meaningful, when we should be banding together and organising ourselves as hospo workers and standing up to bosses who pay poverty wages and treat us as nothing more than units of production to exploit.
So in the RNZ report released today, Aisha Green, who has worked in the hospitality industry for 12 years, said employers like migrant workers because they were cheap and compliant. What do you make of that?
I think compliant is not the right word. I think the word scared would be a much better word. And yeah, overwhelmingly, migrant workers do become part of the black economy, which is being paid less than minimum wage under the table, which means even though hospitality is already the least regulated industry with almost no union representation, they have even less rights and less ability to negotiate and have fairness at work. Yeah, so I don't think the cause of wage suppression. Wages have always been incredibly low in hospitality. It is the lowest paid industry in our country. That is not new migrant workers' fault.
Do you think migrant workers in the hospitality industry are being abused?
Yeah, absolutely. So I launched something called Raise the Bar about 4 months ago. It is a campaign that aims to advocate for hospitality workers. I give out free legal advice. I've taught myself employment law. I'm aiming to raise the conditions of hospitality workers. And yeah, like without a doubt, they're just being treated appallingly and they're being abused. I talk to migrant workers nearly every day on the ground who are in the backs of kitchens who are just being treated appallingly. And it's a national disgrace as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
So what do you think needs to change?
So overwhelmingly, first of all, hospitality workers need to start organising themselves. If they'd like to do that, they can contact me through Raise the Bar. I am pushing to connect hospitality workers with each other so that we can start a movement that pushes bosses to pay us equally and fairly. They can also start demanding things also from welfare, like a insecure work benefit, because overwhelmingly we're stuck in precarious work in hospitality. We're offered casual contracts which offer us absolutely no consistency of hours. So if we can get our wages topped up, it means we're more empowered and it means we can start pushing back against the injustices we face. So yeah, just get a hold of me and start teaching yourself employment law. That's another thing. Like once you know your rights, once you know where you stand, you can start fighting back, and I'm happy to come and advocate.
Do you think if businesses are relying on a model that relies on cheap labour, do you think it's just a bad business model?
Of course it's a bad business model. All it does is it exploits predominantly the working and lower classes, traps us further into poverty, traps us into a precarious way of life, like over, you know, the CTU sites that 30% of our workforce are actually stuck in insecure work. We've got 600,000 people stuck on the minimum wage in this country, and we're wondering why poverty is rising when we've got rising living costs. Like, it's really time that we shifted towards higher wages, better work conditions, and stronger unionisation for our workers, particularly in HOSPO, which is one of the most insecure industries you can work in.
Mental health is an issue that has been greatly talked about over the last few years, with acknowledgement of its massive impact on New Zealanders beginning to be addressed in mainstream media. However, we still have a long way to go, with New Zealand's suicide rate still being one of the highest in the world. 95BFM reporter Will Parsonson spoke to Ekant Veer, a lecturer on marketing and media from Canterbury University, about the impacts that media can have in changing socially ingrained perceptions of mental health issues.
It's a really difficult thing for me to answer in like 30 seconds, but it is a combination of a lot of things. Most importantly, I think, is it's become a cultural thing. It's become such a taboo. It's become such a stigma to discuss mental illness and to discuss the issues associated with mental illness that as a result, we kind of just ignore it. If I broke my leg walking out of my house, there would be no issues with someone getting a cast put on and me even taking painkillers to take the pain away. But if I was struggling with my mental health, then a lot of people just don't want to even think about it, don't want to talk about it, and definitely won't go and admit it to their partners or their friends or anything like that. So we need to find a way that we can break the stigma in a healthy way and encourage people to seek the help they really need.
Do you think New Zealand is worse at that than a lot of other countries? Because it is part of our culture, and especially with men, it's sort of this lag culture that you don't talk about your feelings and you keep those sort of things bottled up. Is that an issue that's very important to New Zealand rather than other places?
Yeah, I mean, if it's not important to New Zealanders, then it really should be, because we have the highest teen suicide rate in the developed world. We have a significantly higher male suicide rate in New Zealand compared to many of our normal cultural partners like Australia. I think Australia is like 54th when it comes to male suicide. I think the UK is 123rd when it comes to male suicide. We're 34th in the whole world, developing and developed countries. When it comes to male suicide. So this is something that we really need to start thinking about a lot more and taking more seriously. Now, what causes that is a complex issue, but it needs to be taken seriously, not just by individuals in society, but by our leaders and our politicians as well.
Do you think that the fact that we don't publicise or acknowledge suicides that much in sort of mainstream or media that's shown to everyone, is that something that's influencing this, or is it deeper than that?
It's a really complex issue. I mean, I am not a fan of publishing suicides. I understand the reason for that. We know that there is the potential for copycats when we do actively publish suicide. And this is part of the tension that we're discussing in this lecture tonight, in that if we start talking about this too openly, we can almost glorify it and make it seem like it's a cool thing to do. And you don't want to go that far either. The problem is, when you completely shut down not just the media, but also community talking about this sort of issue, then it does increase the stigma and it does increase the taboo. And when you have that taboo, people don't feel able or open enough to talk about this with people when they really are struggling and they really do need help.
Yeah, I feel like it's sort of a double-edged sword there. If you don't talk about it, then it's not brought into the public eye and people aren't aware of the issue and don't address the issue. But if you talk about it too much, then like you say, it does become glorified.
Absolutely. And so there's a number of really good investigative journalism pieces that are being put out that really take a conscious and a nuanced approach to this that doesn't glorify it. And I think we need more and more of that, but it's becoming difficult with the way that the media is being forced to put out quick articles rather than in-depth, long-term articles. We also need more of our politicians, in my mind, talking about this. We need more of our local government talking about this. And we need the funding to support those people who are really working on the front line of this every single day.
How do you think media could have a massive impact on this situation? What sort of ideas and discussions need to be put through mainstream media to help this issue?
Sure. So let's take a really easy example, which happened about 4 or 5 months ago when Jono on the Jono and Ben show shared about his friend who took his own life. And it was very emotional, very heartfelt, very authentic display of emotion and loss from someone toward their friend. What we do know amongst men in particular, when they saw that, there was a real outpouring of support rather than vindication or toughen up, man up sort of thing, which a lot of people are afraid of. When we can have the mainstream media, when we can have even pop culture talking about this in a nuanced but also authentic way, you're going to see a lot more people think it's okay to feel this way and it's okay to seek help for this and it's okay to use the services. One of the problems we have in New Zealand is that a lot of people know that services exist, but very few people are willing to access those services. So we need to find a way where we can break that stigma, where someone can actually admit to themselves, yes, I can't do this on my own. Yes, I need help. And here's how I can get help. So all the money in the world going to the doctor isn't going to help if no one ever goes to the doctor. We need to get to that step.
The Roaring Silence is a book about suicide awareness, compromising of contributions from 79 artists, writers, poets, and a few professionals from all generations and backgrounds around Aotearoa. 95BFM reporter Amanda Jane Robinson spoke to Lynn Lawton, one of the contributors, about the purpose and the content of the book.
Last year, we'd had a number of young people from local high school in the area take their lives. One was just three doors up the road from where we are located here in Devonport. And in the past, we've always had a concern for the whole issue of suicide. In fact, back in 2000, the Death My Space hosted an exhibition to raise awareness of that particular issue, and it looked like it was timely to do the same thing again. But this time we went about it a bit different. We felt we needed to put together some kind of document that began to demystify the whole subject of suicide and inspire conversation about it. And so we emailed or we contacted and put out into the public arena a request for people who had been through that experience or who also may have known someone who has, whether they'd like to contribute something for this book in terms of poetry or art or prose or their story or something else like that. And we were overwhelmed. We had about 100 people submit different things like that, and we put them together into a publication called The Roaring Silence.
And so of those 100, there are 79 contributors in the final product of the book.
Yeah.
How did you go about kind of selecting those submissions?
Well, there were 79, and in the end, there were 79 that actually kind of stayed in the course, and finally, after indicating they would be interested in doing something, actually submitted something. So the 79 weren't selected. They were basically anyone who contacted us and provided work like that we put into the book. And there's a section in the book that is quite, let me just say what it's titled, Raw, because it was pretty raw material and we felt we wanted to still provide a space for it. So we put a separate section in the book, and just with an annotation at the beginning to the fact that this is a raw area, so just be aware of the sensitive content to it, of it. And so people, when they approach that section, can choose to skip over it, or else, be aware that it is just a person's very raw story about their own experience or someone else's.
And this was quite a community-led project. Why is that important?
Well, my experience in working in this area is that people's isolation is one of the critical factors to people finding themselves in a place where they seriously contemplate and actually take their lives. Because, I've worked with people in this area over a number of years in my previous role as a chaplain in the Royal New Zealand Navy. And we found that if people were in some way approached, were able to begin to disclose at a point that was not too far down the line, then resources could be brought to them and they could access such resources, and very often it could change the whole course. So to me, isolation is a critical factor in people at times finding themselves at that point of no return.
And I guess suicide is still positioned as this taboo thing that's not talked about enough in New Zealand, even though we have such a high rate of it. Why do you think that is?
Well, New Zealand is one of the few countries in the world, up to recently, where you could not even in a newspaper note that a person had taken their lives or any information about that out of fear of copycat. And we've had a situation recently in a district health board in the South Island where Michael King was not provided the opportunity to speak to young people in that area and to provide some kind of input to them because of the view by people down there that this should not happen because copycats would take place. And so that's an example of the way it's been very much cloistered or very much, you know, put into the cupboard out of fear. I think that's, been one of the key things there. And it's very interesting if you read the New Zealand Herald today, they have a lead article on the front page about it, and they comment that this very fear has not been substantiated by research that's been done, where there is someone who takes their life, if there's people at sort of a distance around them and they have, you know, not been intimately close with that person, the likelihood of that leading to that person's own suicide is very rare. But when it's within a family whānau group, well, then there's a greater chance because of the emotional impact on that person on them. So I think it's a lack of understanding of just the whole dynamic of suicide, how it happens, why it happens, and what is the nature of the dynamics amongst people when it happens. You know, all those factors have been not really understood because it's been kept hidden and not really researched and explored in a way that could be of advantage and asset to us.
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95bfm.com and check out the BCasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/BCasts.